You're listening to Death of the Reader. This is Herds. So you're listening to Tuasiao in a 7.3, and this is review season, where we line up all of our favorite murder mysteries, which just so happen to be the ones that we covered on this show.
Whoa, Herds.
Whoa, crazy. Whoa.
Happy New Year.
Also, Happy New Year. That's the other thing that I meant to say and then forgot about. Happy New Year.
Oh, my goodness. Herds. What are your murder mystery New Year's resolutions?
Read more books. That's like a big one. Cook more food.
Oh, good one too.
Cook more exciting food. You know, the noodles and egg sausage combo can only get me so far in life. Migaraine, to be specific. Some might say I never truly left university life.
That's fair enough.
Yeah. I'm just excited to experience more things and learn more about the grand design of murder mystery.
I'm really looking forward to this this season, specifically because we're starting it with Benjamin Stevenson, who is definitely making fun of me.
You mean the book or in general?
Everyone in my family has killed someone is definitely making fun of specifically me. Whether or not it intends to, I believe it intends to.
Awesome. Well,
it's just uncanny sometimes.
Well, look, I haven't actually completely finished the novel yet, so I'm looking forward to seeing how it makes fun of both of us and how I can leverage that to my advantage on the game board, which is what we call the show now.
Absolutely. We're starting Herds with your honorable mention today.
We are. Hold on to your hats, because I will be covering The Torrent by Danuka McKenzie.
I am really looking forward to, once I get back to Australia, going to the book launch in Sydney for the following novel, Taken.
Taken.
No yeah, relation to the Liam Neeson movie, though I really hope Liam Neeson comes to the book launch. I've sent him an email. He hasn't responded.
Yeah, I just hope that he like mixes up to fan conventions where he's like, yes, I'm going to the re-release of the movie Taken. It's been remastered with CG or something. And he ends up at Danuka McKenzie's launch.
Maybe I should have played that angle in my emails, but I tried to be a bit more sincere.
That's okay. This is why I'm the clever one.
It's true.
Because I come up with half-brained schemes that would never work.
Half-brained?
Half-brained. Half-brained! You heard me. Sorry. Okay.
Let's jump into the torrent.
Please take it away, me. Take it away. This is review season on Death of the Reader. Herds here, and I'm bringing to you now our second honorable mention. We've read a lot of murder mysteries off the beaten track this year, but by far, Danuka McKenzie's The Torrent stood out to me personally as the closest to the beating heart of what we do here on Death of the Reader. The Torrent is such a fantastically Australian tale with how it takes the typical tropes of a police drama and flips them on their head upside down. We're all familiar with the classic trope of the cop just 1 week from breaking retirement, but how many of us are familiar with the cop just 1 week from breaking their water? In this story, we follow one Kate Miles, happily married policewoman with a loving husband and a small child that depends on her to bring home the bacon. Family is the central axis that everything spins around, with McKenzie throwing us into a small town named Esserton in northern New South Wales. The town is small enough that most people know each other, but also big enough that time is always a looming factor. It's the perfect place for rumors to circulate. And as time becomes more of a factor, the trail threatens to go cold on a group of hooligans who hold up a local restaurant chain. The passage of time threatens to wash away the memory of a husband lost to the titular torrent some months ago, back in the summer season. Time pushes Kate's relationship with her family to a strain, and she has to solve all of these problems and more before she has her next child. That is not to say that this is an action drama. Kate herself is not quite up to vaulting over fences, although she does push herself. This is such a defining trait of her character that even as her baby is threatened to pop out onto the street in the middle of the investigation, she has to keep going. She has to keep chasing the truth. But the novel is content to explore the relationships that the denizens of the town of Esserton have with the criminals of this story. We're using the family framework to show how rifts can form between loved ones, the lengths that people will go to secure their own happiness, and above all, what is most important in life. One aspect of the novel that I really enjoyed chatting with Mackenzie about when she joined us on the show was the portrayal of mental illness. It's a very easy and common solution to any crime story to unmask the culprit and simply say, well, they were crazy, psychotic, off the wall, so of course they killed the victim. What else would they do? But Mackenzie is dedicated to go against that instinct, painting all the villains in the story with an empathetic coat. There's one character in particular who is portrayed as being on the autistic spectrum, and you can tell that they were well-researched and written with a mother's eye, prioritizing what you would love and cherish about this person and how you would look after them in spite of their difference, rather than exploiting this character trait to create shortcuts within the story. Everyone in here feels very human, and I can appreciate that. Kate herself is a half Sri Lankan pregnant woman serving on a police force almost entirely surrounded by men, and you can tell that Mackenzie draws upon her own lived-in experience to portray this character authentically to an outsider. The novel is driven by modern political commentary, and the fears that Kate harbors for her own children are demonstrated in the many different characters and archetypes that she meets and pursues along the way to the finish line. There are injustices in the world that Kate is driven to uncover and expose to the world, even if the truth may hurt more than it saves. But something that the novel takes great pains to highlight to us is that truth, more often than not, lies at the bottom of the river, and that easily told lies by pretty faces are much easier to accept than crude truths spoken by the easily pushed aside. If this lengthy ramble hasn't convinced you that The Torrent is worth checking out for its societal commentary alone, I would also like to assure you that the plot did keep me guessing right up until the very end. It is not a true murder mystery. That's why I could never quite find an excuse to bring it to the game table. But there is plenty of mystery to sift through alongside Kate's search for truth, justice, and the Australian way. I would recommend picking up a copy of Danuka McKenzie's The Torrent if you're looking for something that could be personally challenging to read, as well as if you are looking for the next classic Australian murder mystery set with one foot squarely in the bush. You can find The Torrent published in Australia by HarperCollins, and I thoroughly recommend taking a copy of this with you when you next go camping out in the wilds, if only as a cautionary tale of what can go wrong when the tide rises and the water gets choppy. You're listening to Death of the Readers review season. Don't forget to subscribe for more of us on your app of choice, and let us know at Flex and Herds what murder mystery you'll be tackling next year. This is Herds, and you're on 2CR 107.3.
Well, Herds, what a wonderful honorable mention that you've brought this year, and it's time to get back to the list proper.
I know. Yeah.
We return once again. We've had three subcontinental novels in a row.
Mm.
A Dire Isle, The Shadows of Men, The Bombay Prince. What a trifecta taking out the central portion of our list this year.
I know. Honestly, it's a good thing that we had The Torrent in the middle just to kind of break things up. But yeah, look, these are all excellent novels. We love our Indian crime fiction. We discovered it kind of last year, and it just keeps on swinging. And I'm so glad to see these three kind of nestled in together. I think that to separate them would be a tragedy. So,
or just very challenging.
Very challenging. Both. A challenging tragedy. But yeah, the next novel up on the list is me again. I'm talking about The Bombay Prince by Sujata Massey.
I mean, I had a great time reading Murder on Malabar Hill, the first one in the series, as sort of background research for it. I just love the way that novel kicks off with Parveen's friend coming back to Bombay because she was caught being a lesbian. That was...
How dare she?
What a great start to a novel series set in colonial India.
I mean, look, it's a bit of a tone setter, isn't it? Like, you understand where the politics stand right from the get-go. Yeah, it's great. It's great.
Anyhow, Herds, let's jump in to The Bombay Prince by Sujata Massey, and then we return for our last review of the day.
You're listening to Review Season, Herds here, and today we're going to continue a discussion a whole year in the making, as we look at the tail end of our coverage of modern Indian crime fiction, which we started last year. As part of our breakdown in 2021, Flex and I had a nice long chat about how Indian murder mystery is a perfect genre to rediscover the heritage of India itself. It is a genre that is all about going through incredibly difficult and complicated and often thankless work in order to uncover long forgotten and inconvenient truths that expose the true villains of a story. This lends itself well to the Indian authors seeking to reconnect with their past wiped clean by the rampant destruction of British colonialism. The Bombay Prince by Sujata Massey, then, which covers the arrival of Prince Edward VIII in Bombay through the eyes of India's first and at present only female lawyer, Parveen Mistry, is primed to open our eyes to the everyday conflicts that erupt between the British powers and the everyday Indian citizen, as well as everyone in between that is caught up in this historical struggle of identity. It's best to tackle the symbology and historical context of the central set piece of the novel, the arrival of the prince to reassert his presence in Indian lives. It is an event that our protagonist Parveen is loath to take part in, as she sees it as a meek acceptance of their British masters. A new professional client of hers, Freddy Cutting Master, young schoolgirl, feels similarly. The action of the story kicks off as Frenny comes to Parveen in order to seek guidance on whether or not she, as a student of a prestigious school and conscientious objector of the prince, should attend. Frenny is a young Parsi girl, which puts her in the awkward position of not being truly Indian or British, as many Parsi families were able to make strong financial alliances with the British once they saw which way the wind was blowing. Frenny is strongly political, but knows that if she follows her heart and does not attend the prince's tour, she could get herself and her family into quite a bit of trouble. It could even include expulsion from her school, a perceived fate worse than the death, which inevitably befalls her just off screen from the prince's reception as the action kicks off. As the prince passes the crowds and our suspects are lined up in the stands for a camera shot, a young girl seemingly falls to her death. It is, of course, up to Parveen to determine whether or not her death had been accidental in this murder mystery story, and if not, then who could have possibly murdered her? This leads to a rather unique frame for the story as we follow a female lawyer, in which she should not be, investigating the death of a girl who attended a school that Parveen obviously has no business being near, under the scrupulous gaze of the police, who seem to suspect Parveen just as much as anyone else after she arrives at the scene of the crime for hardly any reason at all, as far as they're concerned. Just a story of a young girl coming to her for help. Above all of this tale hangs the shadow of romance. Parveen is an incredibly intelligent woman, and she is able to use the social status of her father, who leads the law practice that she works under, more a formality to keep her out of trouble than anything else. But as the third book in the Parveen mystery series, she has already started spinning the tight thread of love with one Colin Aith Sandringham, a British Secret Service type. The classic woes of a will-they-won't-they romance, when the two of them are born of two rival houses, are fantastically woven into the politics that Massey is framing here. And on a mechanical level, being in a non-relationship with a practical spy means that Parveen isn't just constantly getting into trouble, a behavior that her father is firmly against, but because of the people that she knows on the British side of the coin, she always knows exactly how much trouble she could be in at any given moment. And it's a lot. Bar one moment, there is exactly one point in the story towards the end that had me cackling with how extreme the stakes are driven up. Not to say that the novel doesn't maintain a constant state of tension. The death of Frenny, the arrival of the prince, the teachings of Gandhi, these all contribute to rapidly rising unrest in the very streets of Bombay. The city is practically on fire before we even hit the halfway point. It is only through the extreme capabilities of the charming supporting cast that Parveen has access to that gives her any chance at survival. The novel lends itself well to being both a deep political discussion and a tension-building blast through the streets as windows are smashed and weapons are fired off and brutal brawls spill out everywhere. The Bombay Prince by Sujata Massey is an excellent novel to get yourself into the Indian murder mystery scene, not being quite as intricate on the mystery side as something like Dying Day, nor as heavy or depressing as Murder in Old Bombay, which we covered on the show last year. I'd recommend The Bombay Prince if only to observe one of the greatest inquest scenes ever put to paper, with some complex clues woven into a fascinating look into the bureaucracy of death and murder. I really was fascinated at the time of reading by the fact that if the Parsi family of poor Frenny had their way as it stands in the novel, there would be hardly any investigation at all, and Frenny might never have had even a small chance of justice, which is what lawyers are all about, no? This is review season. I'm Herd, so you once more to please subscribe to your platform of choice to stay up to date with all our murder mystery goodness. What's been your favorite flavor of crime this year? Let us know at Flex and Herd. So you're listening to 2SCR 107.3.
The Beths, expert in a dying field. This is your murder mystery world tour. Happy review season. Happy New Year. Stick around.
History, is it as easy as this? Plausible deniability, I swear I've never heard of it. And I can close the door on us, but the room still exists, and I know you're in it. Hours of phrases I've memorized, thousands of lines on the page. All of my notes in a desolate pile I haven't touched in an age. And I can burn the evidence, but I can't bend the pain, and I can't forget it. What does it feel to be an expert in a dying field? And how do you know it's over when you can't let go? You can't let go, you can't stop, can't rewind. Love is learned over time, till you're an expert in a dying field. The city is painted with memory. Birds and the bees and the flowers and trees, they know that we've both been here. And I can flee the country for the worst of the year, but I'll come back to it. How does it feel to be an expert in a dying field? And how do you know it's over when you can't live? You can't let go, you can't stop, can't rewind. Love is learned over time, till you're an expert in a dying field. Can we erase our history? Is it as easy as this? Maybe in other realities, the road never took this twist. And I can close the door on us, but the room still exists. How does it?
Brad Friedman, this is for you. I want to let you know. I mean, we've discussed this on Twitter, so you already know, but just for the sake of dramatic performance for the audience, I challenge you, Brad Friedman, to the second novel in Yukito Aoyatsuji's The Mansion Murder series, The Watermill Mansion Murders, which is out February with Pushkin Vertigo. And Herds, I suppose you should explain why I'm mentioning Brad Friedman right now.
Well, obviously because I am now covering the book that he brought to our table to challenge us with the greatest of wits and machinations and black magic. It's going to be The Crooked Hinge by John Dixon Carr. It was a phenomenal novel to tackle alongside Flex to solve it together as a team.
What a treat.
Yeah, we don't get to do it very often.
I remember us having a briefing before our second episode, and Herds was listening to me explain mm-hmm. what I thought my theory was, which I can't go into.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this pause where Herds pondered the thing that I just said and exclaimed epiphanously something that I had only tangentially uh-huh. realized. And this book went from like a fun solve to stratospheric in moments as Herds glued that last piece of the puzzle together for me.
It was truly heroic of me, I would say, to take
I completely
a theory
agree with because absolutely the- not a shred of irony.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Look, we know what's going on here. Look, watching you be a hair away from committing to the perfect solution and then me realizing, oh yeah, like that's it. Like you that's exactly it.
We make a dangerous team.
We do.
So I'm very excited to turn the tables on Brad and have one of us team with him. We'll have to decide who.
That will not end well.
I completely agree, but I'm sure it will be very entertaining.
Goodness, I hope so. I hope that Brad will find that entertaining. I'm sure he will.
Anyhow, let's carry on, Herds, with your review of The Crooked Hinge by John Dixon Carr, part of the Gideon Fell series.
Oh yes, of course. Watch out for that fell. You're listening to Review Season. This is Herds bringing you the sixth place for this year. Just shy of the premium top five, we have placed the fantastically wacky The Crooked Hinge by John Dixon Carr. We have been looking for an excuse to include the tomes of Carr on the show for some time now, and when we heard that ambitious friend of the show, Brad Friedman of Our Sweet Mystery, was keen to chat about it, we jumped at the chance. The Hinge represents a unique facet of the Death of the Reader lexicon, and being a novel which outwardly claims to be about the clash between mystery and magic, one which Flex and I had struggled against since the beginning of time itself. Carr penned this story as part of his Gideon Fell series, though Gideon is not allowed proper access to the crime scene until well after the requisite murder even occurs. It is a classic locked room style murder mystery with a mansion, many different maze-like rooms that can be mapped out and sight lines of the characters established, along with a quirky cast to fill out this mansion and sight one another as needed. The central conflict and supposed motive for the murder involves two John Farnleys, both of whom claim religiously to be the real John Farnley, which is, of course, an impossible contradiction. It's a fun play on the traditional twin trope of murder mystery, where rather than having a second Farnley pop up out of the woodwork miraculously at the end of the novel to explain everything, we are instead produced two Farnleys that look nothing like twins, but who both seem to have an equally twin-like claim to the name of John Farnley. And this is the pretext of the novel, as an investigation unfolds that will yield light on the matter, exposing the true Farnley to all and casting the fake one into disgrace. The one Farnley has been dwelling in the estate of their family for years, though admittedly seems nervous when the nature of their identity is called into question. The other Farnley has a pretty wild story implicating that the two of them had been on the real actual Titanic together when it went down, survived, and that the real Farnley had their identity taken over by the fake. The intrigue, of course, comes from whether this convincing newcomer really is telling everything exactly as he says, or perhaps everything that comes out of his mouth is a well-prepared lie. With this debate splitting readers down the middle, it also splits the cast. Which of these characters might support which of the Farnleys? Which is secretly doing whom's bidding? None of it is clear, and just as we were about to perform the early 20th century equivalent of a DNA test, the evidence is stolen and one Farnley is slaughtered in broad daylight in front of everyone, right in the middle of the courtyard. It's bold, it's cunning, it's so very Carr. What follows after a dense opening is a deep dive into impossible crimes and the mystical nature of the world itself. Black books of magic are discovered, an automaton attempts to slaughter a housemaid. As day turns to night and the shadows grow longer, it is no longer clear what is real and what is magical. An offhand comment about a circus performance primes the reader's brain to accept anything and everything, whether you believe there is a rational explanation or not. At a certain point, you're just along for the ride as much as the characters are. That is, if not for Dr. Fell. Dr. Gideon Fell is an imposing figure, keen to engage in a battle of great wits to any he may come across. He operates on his own whims and is akin to a boulder rampaging down a tight corridor. He's going to catch up with the truth, it's just a matter of when. The mystery to this story is devilishly laid out, and clues which might be hidden in the last place a reader would suspect. What I really admired about this text was how Carr was able to keep the action thrumming along while still injecting hints in the form of metaphor and symbology. There is a logic behind everything that's placed here, and not one sentence is wasteful. This philosophy extends to the broader cast. As though Fell is our detective, he is not our protagonist. That honor goes to an impressionable young Brian Page, who is swept up in the business of telling the Farnleys apart as a witness rather than as active participant. But it soon becomes apparent that by setting foot within the Farnley conspiracy, he has exposed himself to the threats and machinations of such figures as Knowles, the family butler, who continues to insist that he has excellent eyesight despite seeing basically nothing, or Mr. Welkin, a vampiric, crotchety old man who is determined to fight tooth and nail for the claimant Farnley. There's Kenneth Murray, the one man who reckons he can tell the two apart and who knows everything, though he seems to be holding something quite close to his chest as he goes about his investigation. Even in this argument where it should be obvious to someone who has known Farnley his whole life, which is the real one, there is doubt and darkness that shrouds the whole tale, just as it shrouds the whole blasted estate. I would really recommend that you read John Dixon Carr's The Crooked Hinge if you're looking for a brain scratcher of a puzzle. It is an older text, first penned in 1938, but its impeccable sense of place and use of extraordinary elements, which keep you enthralled in its spell from beginning to end. Its mystery is fair, while still looking to pull out the legs from under you at any opportunity, and its intricacies could easily make it your favorite murder mystery of all time. You're listening to Death of the Reader. This has been Herds, reviewing The Crooked Hinge by John Dixon Carr. Let us know at Flex and Herds what your top 10 or 20 or more murder mystery novels of this year looks like. We'd love to know. You're listening to Tour CR 107.3.
This is Death of the Reader, your murder mystery world tour. You're on review season, and Herds, Happy New Year once again. Thank you so much for putting in the hard yards after I covered Christmas.
I know. It was, honestly, I feel like I wrote these reviews in a bit of a frenzy, a bit of a, you know, like I just wanted to get those creative juices flowing and spit it out everywhere. And that's where we landed. No, I had a great time doing these reviews. It's always fun getting to talk about things that I love. And what better time than New Year to talk about something you love?
Exactly. It is currently 5:30 in the morning here on New Year's Day, where I am in the deep, dark, cold of the frigid north. Mm-hmm. But you know what, Herds? I'm glad that I get to spend this time with you, even if my brain is screaming at me to sleep.
Look, you should go to bed, but I think that friendship is more important than sleep. I think that, you know, you can survive without sleep. You cannot survive without friendship. So
can I share a story from the 2SCR Christmas party this year?
Of course you can. Does it involve friendship?
Yes, yes. You were explaining to someone behind me. I don't actually remember who off the top of my head, and I'm not going to knock on them even if I did. How we met and started Death of the Reader. And I was taking part in an entirely separate conversation several feet away. And at some point during the conversation, you said that we were acquaintances when we first started working on media together. And both of us paused our conversation, looked at each other across the room, and I pointed at you and said, "No, enemies."
Yeah.
And we went right back to our conversation.
Look, that's accurate. That's exactly right.
It was such a moment of beautiful synergy that I just wanted to share how much I treasured that.
Look, it's like when the criminal and the detective of a murder mystery novel, I'm the criminal, obviously. Let's be real here.
Agreed.
They have a moment where they realize that they're both equally smart and equally handsome.
I don't know about that.
And they both love killing people and they want to be best friends. But they can't, which is why at the end of this series, one of us is going to jail for some sort of crime.
I know exactly what the crime is going to be, but we currently are not allowed to mention it on air.
Okay. I'm concerned because I can think of several crimes. I'm just not sure which of them are worth going to jail and which would result in summary execution.
I think if I were allowed to tell you right now, you would agree immediately. But we will put a button in that and see you next week for review season on Death of the Reader.
Yeah.
You're listening to 2SER 107.3.